Well, my 21-year-old granddaughter's in her third year of college in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. And she sent me a text last week that said, "Papa," that's what she calls me, "Papa, did you hear about a crashed UFO here?" And I told her, "Ari, I sure have." And I told her a little bit and also said, "You need to listen to the program on Thursday night, because our reporter, Linda Moulton Howe, has got a huge story about that." So there's a whole bunch of girls in a college dorm right now. God knows what they're doing, but I know they're listening to the program down there. So Linda will be joining us in just a moment with this incredible story of Cape Girardeau's 1941 crash of a purported UFO. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with, of course, Linda Moulton Howe, our investigative reporter, who's got probably one of the greatest stories I've ever heard in a long time. Linda, this is amazing. I remember back in my news director days in St. Louis, we were talking about this Cape Girardeau episode. I think it's as big as Roswell.
Well, it is definitely earlier, at least 6 full years before the other crashes that we've heard about in Roswell, New Mexico in July of 1947. We're going back to April 12th, 1941. And it's interesting that it was in the release of some of the documents to Bob Wood and Bob and Ryan Wood's Majestic documents that we all, for the first time, saw in something called the Project White Hot Intelligence Estimate Preliminary that states about UFO crashes, quote, "Based on all available evidence collected from recovered exhibits currently under study, these recovered evidences are deemed extraterrestrial in nature. This conclusion was reached as a result of comparisons of artifacts from the Missouri discovery in 1941, and we're talking about Cape Girardeau. The technology is outside the scope of U.S. science, outside even that of German rocket and aircraft development," close quote. And then, jumping to part five in this white-hot intelligence estimate, from 1947. It's now a title, National Security Structure, and it says, quote, "With the passage of the National Security Act of 1947 and the historical discovery of extraterrestrial hardware and live extraterrestrial creatures, this has presented an unprecedented situation with regard to maintaining secrecy related to the information contained in this report. Even the recovery case of 1941, again, Cape Girardeau, it did not create a unified intelligence effort to exploit possible technological gains, with the exception of the Manhattan Project, which is to develop the atomic bomb. This MJ-12 White Hot document references technology and alien bodies retrieved from a Cape Girardeau, Missouri crash. And the date now that we're working with is April 12, 1941. The MJ-12 document refers to a, quote, neutronic propulsion device from a UFO crash in, and it says and implies, Missouri, 1941. And this was given to physicist Robert Oppenheimer to apply to his Manhattan Project's atomic bomb creation, which was first tested at White Sands, New Mexico in July 1945 and dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan a month later in August 1945. Now, longtime resident of Cape Girardeau, 53-year-old Paul Blake Smith has written a new 2016 book entitled The Bombshell Before Roswell about the April 1941 Cape Girardeau crash. In the process, he learned there is a high probability that the three identical beings and their damaged disc were first transported to Washington, D.C., to a subterranean basement underneath the Capitol. Paul speculates, that the three extraterrestrial bodies, allegedly in jars, and the pieces of damaged spacecraft were shown to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, his Secretary of State Cordell Hull, his Secretary in Army Chief George Marshall, and then powerful Missouri Democrat Senator Harry S. Truman, head of the Senate Special Committee to investigate the National Defense Program. Those powerful men would have been sworn to secrecy in the interest of national security, and they would have remained silent. But here now, from Springfield, Missouri, to take us back to the UFO crash in Cape Girardeau on the night of April 12, 1941, is Paul Blake Smith.
It seems that Pastor William G. Huffman came back to his Cape Girardeau home fairly late, looking pretty pale and shaken, one night in mid-April of 41. His family was very concerned, so he said, "I'll tell you this once, and I will never tell you what happened to me again." He said he received a phone call from someone earlier that evening, presumably from a Cape policeman or police associate, to go to an airplane crash reported outside of town to see if the Reverend could offer some amount of spiritual comfort. When the two men got to the crash site, they found a fire blazing, being fought by firemen. It surrounded a crashed metal spaceship that was silvery gray and round. It was damaged, laying on the ground with metallic debris in the grass. Nearby were three identical gray aliens, almost as if they were released from a cookie cutter. The aliens that we recovered were, quote, incinerated from within, so they could not breathe our atmosphere and had burned their inner organs, and that's why they would appear intact on the outside, as they did in Cape Girardeau.
Without any damage to the surface of their bodies.
That's correct. The aliens were pulled from the Cape Girardeau crash, and two were set out in the grass side by side, and a third was attempting to breathe. Reverend Huffman said he could see this one's chest going up and down until it finally expired. And two of them were clearly dead and lifeless. A third was gasping for air in the grass, laying on his back, unable to breathe our oxygen-rich atmosphere. None of the three had any visible injuries. Reverend Huffman said prayers over the last creature before it died and went limp right in front of him. Then he got up and he peeked into the spaceship through the damaged hull and noticed its small instrument panel and dials and knobs and even a couple of small seats, along with a silver metal band around the inside of this cockpit or flight deck, and it was studded with odd indecipherable symbols. At the site were FBI agents, policemen, firemen, and at least two newsmen with big flash cameras blazing, and assorted farm people picking through the rubble. One dead alien was actually propped up and posed in a photograph.
Can you give a detailed description now from the top of the head to the bottom of the feet of what you have learned from people who saw the photo?
There were no feet visible in the photo. However, Charlotte Mann said that when she saw it many times, the creature was being propped up under the arms by two men, one in shirt sleeves, one in a light waistcoat, she calls it. And the creature had a large, bulbous head with big, black, shiny eyes, just almost like a doll's eyes. And it had almost no nostrils, maybe tiny dots, and a slit for a mouth, just very tiny, long, thin arms and legs, and gray with a crinkly, silvery-looking skin or coating of some kind, or flight suit. And that it clearly had the three fingers and one long thumb per hand in a flash photo. And the person who took the picture, according to Reverend Huffman, stuck the camera back in his shirt pocket where he had found it. This was his second camera. He was also using a large speed graphic type flashbulb camera as if he was a newsman. And this same person came to the Huffman home 2 weeks later and handed over a copy of the photograph he took with the smaller camera and said, "I have a copy of this. I want you to have a copy of this."
And that confusion about using the large flash camera and a smaller camera, does that reinforce for you the possibility that this person taking photos at the extraterrestrial crash site in Cape Girardeau was working for a military agency?
I find it very likely this was a local newsman who was called and rushed to the site, and he was a big photo camera bug, and he had one with him that was a smaller one, but he had a working news-type camera with a flash and attachment and was taking pictures at that time with it, and maybe ran out of camera film is what I'm thinking, why he produced a second smaller camera that he smuggled past the Army and got out of the site.
Paul, why wasn't this on the front page of every Missouri newspaper the very next day with the photo or photos this man took?
Apparently, according to Reverend Huffman, everyone was sworn to secrecy. And when you think about it, if you were to come forward after the crash when everyone else was sworn to secrecy and say, I was there, I took pictures of a flying saucer that crashed and aliens, you would probably be drummed out of your job and out of your church, and you would lose your way of life in the area and probably lose the respect of people who had no idea that it was the truth.
But the evidence would have been there. It would have been the photo in the paper, and it could have cracked it open, and the truth could have been there right back in April of 1941.
I find it very possible that someone went to the editor of the Cape Girardeau newspaper and told him, you will not run this story. I don't care if you did hear from your newsman who told you all about it. It's interesting to note that President Harry Truman invited the editor and owner of the paper, the publisher, to the White House twice during his presidency. And when his presidency was over, he visited the newspaper's headquarters in Cape Girardeau twice. And on one visit, the report in the paper said, Harry cleared the room of all reporters, friends, and aides to both men and wanted to discuss something that was very secret between himself and the newspaper owner, and it was never revealed later. The Army showed up, surrounded the site, and took people off to the side in groups to warn them and swear them to silence. Do not speak of this. This never happened. This is a matter of national security. You will keep your mouth shut. Put down all notes and photos and debris. So they did as they were told, including Reverend Huffman. And he left with his police associate and went home. And that's when he told the story that night. And as I said, he apparently kept his mouth shut for the rest of his life. 2 weeks later, after the crash, a photographer walked up to the Huffman home on Main Street in Cape and gave William a copy of a snapshot he took with a secondary smaller camera he kept hidden in his pocket. It was of the alien being propped up by two men in civilian attire. One man was in shirt sleeves. It was so warm. It was the gray, big-headed alien in the picture, about 4 feet in height. And it scared Charlotte when she saw it about a dozen or so years later.
And Charlotte Mann was his granddaughter.
Correct. She claimed she saw the picture at least 12 times, maybe more, when she was a little girl growing up in a small town in Kansas. Her father would trot out the picture at family parties, and she heard little mentions of this Cape Girardeau UFO crash incident.
Was the person calculated on the part of counterintel to befriend the father specifically to get the photo and never return it?
Well, Reverend Huffman's son, Guy Huffman, ran a furniture store in a small town in Kansas. Across the street was an insurance salesman, and his name was Walter Wayne Fisk. And Mr. Fisk struck up conversations in this small town with Guy Huffman, and the subject came around to extraterrestrials. And that's when Guy Huffman mentioned he had a photograph that he wanted Mr. Fisk to take a look at. Fisk was most keen to see it, came over to a dinner party one night, and said, well, this is most interesting. I'll take it home and look at it more closely, since I'm a photographic expert, and I'll tell you whether I think it's a fake or not. He did not only not return the picture, he left town shortly thereafter, and they never saw him again. There was a story in the Los Angeles Times a number of years ago that revealed that AIG Insurance Company was invented as a front for American intelligence to squeeze information out of Americans. It was co-run by General William Donovan, who worked for Franklin Roosevelt, and they would send intelligence agents out into the field posing as insurance agents to get Americans to talk about their personal and private lives and feed back the information to intelligence headquarters. It could be that Walter Fisk was one of these agents, an Army intel officer who was working in insurance to gather information, and when he found the photograph, at least in theory, he hit the jackpot. He knew that this was something that had to be scooped up and gotten away from the Huffman family and away from the entire American public. That's a hypothesis.
What is the best information about where the three dead small gray alien bodies were taken, and where was the damaged craft taken?
Apparently, they were all taken by the Sikeston, Missouri Institute for Aeronautics, an Army air base that was called in that night, and that the Sikeston MIA Army people were involved. And it's interesting to note that Charles Root was in charge of the Sikeston MIA air base, and that he was transferred to Sikeston directly from Big Shots in Washington, D.C. So if the crash happened that night, that might explain how someone could have contacted the nearest airbase, which was in Sikeston, about 35, 40 miles away from Cape Girardeau, and how they could have gotten direct orders from Washington to go into the site, take everything over, and haul it back to Sikeston, where it was held probably for about a day or two and flown out.
Gosh, I love that story, Linda.
Well, and back in April 1941, there was a War Department, but George, there was no Pentagon, no Area 51, no CIA, no NSA. So where would secret extraterrestrial bodies in their craft be taken so that no one in the public and the media could find out? That is the fascinating next half hour. But before then, I want to share something that I have found that I just am so surprised by, because it is another mention of 1941, which has to be Cape Girardeau, but it is in an extraordinary paper entitled, quote, UFO Technology and the Imbalance of Power, and it is by physicist and head of the Defense Department Star Wars Space Defense Initiative, Edward Teller, Ph.D., during the Ronald Reagan administration in the 1980s. Listen to this. Quote, this is Edward Teller. We are not engaged in an arms race, but rather in a race of perfecting an integrated program of UFO technology, including extraterrestrial plasma weapons and electromagnetic pulse devices.
Jeez.
But our scientists will not turn to national defense unless they perceive an actual danger to the United States. A danger was perceived in 1939, only 2 years before a UFO was captured in 1941 and the Pearl Harbor, Japan attack. This is so amazing that a lot of people don't even know about this paper today. And it is something that Bob and Ryan Wood found and got into their Majestic Documents website. And I just revisited and was reading this and did not realize that it had referenced 1941. And he said, it is vital that scientists should perceive the danger now before it is too late. What is at stake is not only the prevention of defeat, but prevention of cosmic war. Jeez. Nevertheless, convincing the American scientific community that military UFO research is important is a most difficult undertaking, close quote. My Lord, this was a paper presented by the head of SDI Star Wars in the 1980s, and it references 1941, which is Missouri. And when we come back after this break, it is fascinating to learn about the nation's capital in 41.
And we will be back. Welcome back. Linda Moulton Howe with us, and we're talking about a upcoming book, MO 41, The Bombshell Before Roswell. The story continues. Go ahead, Linda.
Thanks, George. And Paul Smith's new book has just released, and I have the brand new hot link to Amazon at my Earth Files reports tonight, along with lots of images and maps and documents that are in all of my Earth Files reports tonight for what I'm reporting on COAST. And while researching this new book, Paul talked to Canadian researcher Grant Cameron about the first-hand visit of a cousin of the 1941 Secretary of State Cordell Hull, who actually showed his cousin, a reverend, three alien beings in jars under the Capitol in a sub-basement. And when you go back and think about where would they have taken what they assessed to be creatures from outer space crashing in Missouri, at that time, the safest place probably in the United States was the nation's capital. It turns out that it was completed in 1800 atop what we call Capitol Hill at the eastern end of the National Mall in Washington, D.C. And about this sub-basement question, I found in a 1911 Department of the Interior administrative report where they are talking about a change, quote, to displace the large amount of machinery located in the sub-basement of the building, meaning the Capitol, and that they would utilize the space for storage, close quote. And then we know today that there are also three subway systems that connect the Capitol to congressional buildings. But exactly how deep tunnels and sub-basements go beneath the Capitol is not clear. Paul Smith reports in his new book that according to historians, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was found dead on April 12, 1945, Missouri Senator Harry Truman was located down inside a sub-basement that Paul speculates might be the same subterranean floor that the Cape Girardeau gray aliens were stored at least for a while. And now let's pick up my discussion with him about the extraordinary question, where did the beings and the craft go?
In your book on page 249, you write, at the time that FDR died, Harry Truman was found down inside the U.S. Capitol building, off limits to the public, according to historians. He hurried out of the building and by car over to the White House, where he was sworn in. So of all the places Truman could have been 4 years after April 12, 1941, he was either on the very same floor that the three alien bodies from Cape Girardeau were stored in the subterranean capital.
Right. Turns out in the 1990s, two sisters came forward in the state of Ohio and said that their father told them back in the 40s that he had been a visitor to Washington, D.C., and that his cousin, the Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, who worked directly for Franklin Roosevelt, escorted Reverend Turner Holt downstairs to the U.S. Capitol building sub-basement. And from there, he was shown a special storeroom. Inside were three dead aliens inside three glass jars, completely uninjured, matching the same exact description of Reverend Huffman. They were big-headed with big black eyes, and two arms and two legs were most thin with three fingers and one thumb, and they were gray and floating in what appeared to be clear formaldehyde. Mr. Hull told Reverend Holt that these were creatures from another world, but we can't discuss this. He also showed off from underneath a tarp pieces of a round metallic silvery gray spaceship. It was cut into sections in order to fit it into the building. The Masons are wild about the Capitol building for some reason. Almost every member of the Roosevelt administration, it seems, was a Freemason, including the Vice President, Henry A. Wallace, who had an office in the U.S. Capitol building. FDR was said to have been a 33rd degree Mason. He and Harry Truman were both powerful Democrats in those days, and they were both very devout Freemasons. Harry was the Grand Master Mason of the state of Missouri. He was a very powerful figure, getting ready to start his Truman Committee on Military Hearings on Capitol Hill at the time of the UFO crash in Cape Girardeau. So it seems apparent that at least for a little while, the materials were flown from Sykeston, Missouri to Washington, D.C., and not knowing quite what to do with it, President Roosevelt directed George Marshall to take them downstairs to this sub-basement storeroom where they would be well guarded by security and police, and there was almost no one who was aware of these subterranean rooms, but it turns out quite true. I've read many times that there are a number of floors, maybe up to 7 floors down below the surface of the Capitol building. There's actually more room underneath the floor of the Capitol than there is above the congressional floors. There was a memo that Franklin Roosevelt sent to his top scientist, Dr. Vannevar Bush, in 1942, where he discusses Dr. Bush's desire to get more scientific access to the materials recovered by the Army. Celestial wonders, as he called them.
And that means Harry S. Truman had hard, firsthand working knowledge of these 4-foot-tall beings from outer space retrieved from a crash in Cape Girardeau in April of 41, long before the July 47 crashes in Roswell.
That is correct. And it also brings us back to another document called the White House Intelligence Estimate, written by General Nathan Twining for President Truman in September of 1947, in which he mentions in print, and you can still see this today on the Majestic Documents site, quote, "Even the recovery case of 1941 did not create a unified intelligence effort." And later on, he stated, quote, "Based on all evidence collected from recovered exhibits, these items from Roswell are deemed extraterrestrial in nature."
Is there any insight from that 41 period in any document, any leak, anywhere that denotes what the government thought the agenda was of these small gray beings? Were they friendly, unfriendly? Was this part of the danger that FDR perceived?
You know, that's a wonderful question, and I honestly have no idea. I have never read a single document or heard a statement as to whether Roosevelt was nervous or upset or excited or what their emotional reaction to this was. I can tell you that on April 12, 1941, when the crash happened, President Roosevelt was up very late in the White House. Rather unusually late. He didn't go back upstairs to his personal quarters where he lived alone, separate from Eleanor, until after midnight, and where he had 2 telephones to take and make phone calls. At that same time, Eleanor Roosevelt was in Boston, and suddenly, for some reason, her flight was canceled. She and her entourage had to get their bags off the plane, get a taxi, drive across town, go to the train station, and stay on the ground and travel back to Washington, D.C., down the coast in the early morning hours of Easter Sunday. She wrote in her column, "We so look forward to the Knights Templar ceremony at Arlington Cemetery every Easter sunrise, but they didn't make it. Neither Franklin or Eleanor showed up, and they did make it to a late church service around noon in Washington, D.C., and the records show very little activity for the rest of the day. This would have been the day after the crash, according to my estimate."
April 13th, 1941.
Right. So on April 12th, I looked up the records of General George Marshall, the chief of the Army for President Roosevelt. He was down in Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and he was due to fly to Fort Benning in Georgia. He has a printed itinerary. It's all checked down to Saturday night, where it suddenly stops cold, and there's no record of where he went or what he did Saturday night or Sunday, as if he may have been grounded also. It's difficult to pin this down, but he did show up at his office in Washington, D.C. Monday morning and met with President Roosevelt in the days to come. There are no White House telephone records from that period, which is most discouraging. It would have been extremely helpful. But in the days after the crash, some of the biggest of the big shots of the American military, including General Marshall, came rolling into the Oval Office for meetings. And one point at 11:45, a few days after the crash, Dr. Vannevar Bush, who's been in many UFO documents, named as someone who's working on the MO-41 materials, came into the Oval Office for an appointment with Dr. Ross McIntyre, the president's physician. It was a very strange pairing, and I asked Ryan Wood about this, and he speculated, but most reasonably, Dr. Bush would have been there to discuss the autopsy of the spaceship recovered. Dr. McIntyre would have been there to discuss the autopsy of the bodies recovered. These were the two men Roosevelt trusted the most, and somebody had to take charge of this material, the hardware and the bodies, and investigate it thoroughly. But we have to remember that in the 1940s, in the early 40s, there was no Pentagon, there was no CIA, there was no National Security Council. None of these things existed. Where would you take aliens where they would be kept under guard and could be examined without too much fuss if the president or vice president showed up to take a look for himself or his army chief of staff? And that would have been the U.S. Capitol building where Vice President Wallace had an office.
How do you think that Harry Truman became aware of the aliens and the extraterrestrial craft at Cape Girardeau in April of 1941?
It is purely speculation, but Mr. Truman was conducting military hearings on Capitol Hill in which he had to deal with General Marshall, who was the person in charge of recovering the Missouri artifacts and hiding them and keeping them under wraps, possibly in the Capitol building, at least for a little while. So I would assume it could have been around that time when Marshall told Harry what they pulled from his home state. Now, once again, that is just speculation on my part.
In April of 1941, what was the title and position of Harry S. Truman?
April of 41, he was starting his second term as Senator of Missouri. He had just won the fall 1940 re-election campaign. Marshall was sworn in and was a hearing committee witness, one of the first ones, in mid-April of 1941, just after the Easter Passover break, in which almost all of this extraterrestrial business took place. And one of the first things that was done, Harry met with General Marshall and swore him in, and he gave testimony before the Truman Committee on Capitol Hill.
About?
That was about military funding and waste in government and funding projects that had to do with supporting the Army. At that time, Harry might have been told. He was a Senate leader, but not the majority leader, and he was very fond of Speaker of the House Rayburn from Texas, and they were both very hardcore Freemasons who keep lots of secrets, and they loved that Capitol building. So Harry may well have been told, I just don't know when, and by who.
But it would explain why FDR would reach out to Harry Truman in the re-election in 1944.
That is correct.
And that Harry S. Truman, as a Freemason in colleagueship with George Marshall, the Secretary of War, would have been a logical choice.
Right. General Marshall and Hap Arnold, the head of the Air Corps turned Air Force in 41, were both hardcore Freemasons. You almost couldn't become a part of the Roosevelt inner circle or cabinet without being a Freemason, including the director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover. And they would all meet at the Washington Masonic sites, and there might have been a Masonic meeting room under the Capitol. And if so, that might explain once again why trusted Freemasons would keep this amazing secret under the Capitol, where it would be guarded by police and maybe even the military.
And George, it was only 10 months after the Cape Girardeau crash that on February 27, 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt sent a memo to his Army Chief of Staff, General George Marshall, about even more UFO retrievals only two nights before from San Bernardino and the Santa Monica Mountains of California, after the famous Battle of Los Angeles, when America's 37th Coast Artillery Brigade fired off 1,430 anti-aircraft shells at a diamond-shaped, glowing craft of unknown origin in the sky. And in this February 27, 1942, White House, Washington, top-secret memorandum for the Chief of Staff of the Army, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt says, quote, I have considered the disposition of the material in possession of the Army that may be of great significance toward the development of a super weapon of war. I disagree with the argument that such information should be shared with our ally, the Soviet Union. Consultation with Dr. Bush, meaning Vannevar Bush, and other scientists on the issue of finding practical uses for the atomic secrets learned from study of celestial devices precludes any further discussion, and I therefore authorize Dr. Bush to proceed with the project without further delay. This information is vital to the nation's superiority and must remain within the confines of state secrets. Any further discussion on the matter will be restricted to General Donovan, Dr. Bush, the Secretary of War, and yourself. The challenge our nation faces is daunting and perilous in this undertaking, and I have committed the resources of the government toward that end. You have my assurance that when circumstances are favorable and we are victorious, the Army will have the fruits of research in exploring further applications of this new wonder. And he's talking about the technology that they are getting and back engineering from craft that they have retrieved, in which their own documents back then are referring to celestial wonders and talking about extraterrestrials. And I think it is amazing today in 2016 to see what was actually going on behind the scenes in our nation's capital, in our best scientists, and the President of the United States, and the people that he was trusting. And they were all keeping extraterrestrials and alien presence and back engineering technologies from off-world, all behind the scenes, while we, for the last 60-some years, have been told we're alone in the universe and there is no truth to UFOs and ETs. It's a remarkable schizophrenic history.
It really is. And this story, Linda, just keeps getting better and better, doesn't it?
Yes. And in the next half hour, more about the dynamic and relationship of what was going on politically, and maybe something that might have happened to FDR that Paul Blake Smith has come upon.
Does he have really good information about what you're going to tell us?
I think so, because what's happened is
shocking.
Is more proliferation of firsthand information passed through family.
Super. And if you ever need to email Linda, that's earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And don't forget, we always reserve the last hour of the program for what we call Conversations with Linda, giving you an opportunity to call her questions. And also, that's where we've gotten lots of whistleblower stories for her from people who are on the inside, and they know something. Back in a moment.